Now today, a special episode with Peter Varghese. Now he's the recently retired head of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and now Chancellor of the University of Queensland. He's also a former High Commissioner to India, former Director General of the Office of National Assessments, and he joined me to talk about our foreign policy challenges. Now, when I spoke to him in early September, the aftershocks of the French winning the bid to build our $50 billion submarine fleet, they were well and truly being felt. So whether you're at the beach or driving or just having a quiet day at home, sit back or lie back and let's get into it. Hi there, Peter.
G'day, Tom. Glad to be here.
Now, let's start with the French submarines. According to The Australian last week, the French shipbuilder, DCNS, they suffered a massive leak of top secret documents. Now, the DCNS, of course, won the bid to design our new $50 billion submarine fleet. Question, how concerned should we be?
Well, by all accounts, the leak is a serious leak, and it would be a matter of concern both for DCNS and for the Indian government, as well as other customers of DCNS. So to that extent, it's something we would want a level of reassurance about in relation to our own submarine program. And I'm sure that's something the company and the Defence Department and the government would be working very assiduously on.
How would you respond to the criticism of the French deal a month or so ago that the subs are overpriced, they're delayed, they're built by an unreliable ally, and they leak top secret data?
Well, I don't know how you could say they've been delayed when the project's only just starting in relation to Australia. But Tom, this decision on the submarines was made after a very exhaustive evaluation process. And it was an evaluation process that went into extraordinary detail on the technical side, on the cost side, and on the timelines. And DCNS came up as the strongest candidate. And I think in those circumstances, the choice was fairly straightforward.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to the South China Sea, Peter. How worried should we be about China's conduct in recent years?
Well, I think what's happening in the South China Sea is a matter of concern for everyone in the region and indeed more broadly, because the big question here is what kind of strategic culture do we want to see embedded in the Indo-Pacific? Is it going to be a strategic culture which rests on the rule of law and responsible behavior, or is it going to be a strategic culture which more approaches the law of the jungle, a might is right strategic culture? That, for me, are the larger stakes in the South China Sea. Not so much a question of freedom of navigation, but what will be the underlying principles behind the handling of strategic issues into the medium and longer term?
Yeah,
so these are big stakes.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let me put you on the spot here. Now, I think as you were leaving ONA or just before you left, you gave a speech to ASPE, the leading think tank in Canberra. This was September 2008. You declared, quote, "China's political system will likely change slowly. Abrupt shifts in China's strategic priorities are unlikely, but could come from an acute threat to party control, especially flowing from an economic crisis. In such a crisis, China is more likely to become self-absorbed than to act aggressively." How then do you account, Peter, for Xi Jinping's calculations in the South China Sea?
Well, Tom, I think the judgment that China's primary priorities are likely to remain domestic still holds true. I mean, we're dealing with a country that faces enormous challenges domestically. I mean, leading and managing a country of that size and an economy of that size is a daunting prospect. I don't shift from that part of the judgment. I think since 2008, we have seen, if you like, a more forward-leaning China in relation to strategic and foreign policy in a way which in 2008 might have looked unlikely. Now, I think that probably reflects a judgment on the part of China that is a window of opportunity for China to pursue its interests more actively particularly since the global financial crisis, which may have been seen rightly or wrongly as signalling a weakness in the position of the United States. Mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm. I happen to think in the longer term that would be a misjudgment. Mm-hmm. I think the capacity of the US system to regenerate is not only historically proven, but likely to be a feature of the next 10 to 15 years. And we're seeing that in relation to a revival, however tepid it might be in parts, in relation to the US economy. The US political system, I think, is another question.
Yeah. On the strategic issue, though, how would you respond to the criticism that you often hear in Asia that the Obama administration has been too timid in checking Beijing's moves? I mean, since October, we've had only 3 Freedom of Navigation patrols through that 12 nautical mile zone. How would you respond to that criticism, Peter?
Well, I think it's important for the US-China relationship to be handled with a great deal of care, because the risk of something going wrong would have horrendous implications. So I don't think it's fair to characterize the Obama administration's approach as a timid one. I think it is trying to manage a very complicated relationship, which brings together not just its economic interests, but its strategic interests. It's in no one's interests for the US and China to move from strategic competition to strategic confrontation. And I think we would all want the leadership on both sides of that relationship to exercise a great deal of careful management.
Yeah. You say the risk of something going wrong would have horrific consequences, I think you said. Is that why we're not following up with Freedom of Navigation patrols?
Well, you know, this is not the touchstone of how we handle our relationship with the US or with China. I mean, at one level, Australia has been conducting freedom of navigation exercises outside of 12 nautical miles for many decades, and we will continue to do that. And it's important that we uphold the underlying principles of freedom of navigation and rights under international law. I don't think Australia should exclude the possibility of going beyond that, but nor do I think we should be rushing into a freedom of navigation exercise within 12 nautical miles. I mean, I think these are matters that are best handled more quietly, as long as we all understand what the underlying principles are.
My guest is Peter Varghese, one of our leading foreign policy makers in recent times, who's now Chancellor of the University of Queensland. Peter, your old boss, John Howard, recently told the Wall Street Journal that China, quote, is exhibiting all of the tendencies of a new great power who has fairly recently arrived on the scene. And the former Prime Minister went on to say that there's a danger in pushing this issue. Is he right?
Well, China, of course, has a long historical tail as a great power. So up until the 1800s, of course, it was a very significant power. But it is certainly the case that we are now seeing a China whose economic rise inevitably will have strategic consequences. And how that plays out, if you like, is the really big question, not Indeed. Just for Australia, but I think globally. Just what is the settling point of China, both in a strategic sense, but also in a political sense? We know that the Chinese leadership is committed to the monopoly power of the Communist Party. We also know that the Chinese leadership is committed to the reform of the Chinese economy, and that a key plank of that reform is a more market-driven Chinese economic model. Now, how the leadership is going to manage a further opening up of the economy while retaining a tight control over the polity is going to be, I think, you know, a big question for the future.
Yeah, but if there's a great power stoush in this part of the world, things could get very difficult for us. Let's get your reaction to something Professor John Mearsheimer, he's the distinguished Chicago University political scientist. This is what Mearsheimer told me a year ago.
Well, I think in a scenario where China is even more powerful than it is today, and the United States is consumed putting together a balancing coalition to contain China, any country in East Asia that does not cooperate with the United States, and this would be especially true of a country like Australia, would feel the white heat of anger from Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam would go to great lengths to coerce the Australians or the Japanese or the Filipinos, whoever, into working with the United States to deal with China. The United States would be very angry if the Australians tried to sort of cut a side deal with the Chinese and cooperate with the Chinese and not work with the United States to contain China.
As John Mearsheimer is saying, that Australia would feel the white heat of Uncle Sam if we did not go all the way with the USA. Peter Varghese.
Well, I don't share the language of containment when it comes to China. I mean, I think containment was a policy that made sense during the Cold War in relation to the Soviet Union, but I don't think it's possible or desirable to contain China, which is a much more integrated member of the global community. But I think the point that John Mearsheimer was making is that an alliance comes with certain obligations. It doesn't come as a carte blanche relationship. I think for Australia, the challenge has always been to know when you can say no to the United States and when you must say yes. And you must say yes when the core strategic interests of your ally are at stake. And I think if we were to find ourselves in a position where the core interests of the United States was at stake or in jeopardy, then as an ally, we would be supportive of the United States. I have no doubt of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get an alternative voice to Professor Mearsheimer. This week, Paul Keating addressed the Australia-China Research Institute at Sydney's UTS. This is Bob Carr's think tank. Let's hear from the former Prime Minister.
The fact is, Australia needs a foreign policy and it needs it urgently. And Australia does not have a foreign policy. You know, that's a big problem. Our aptitude in foreign policy smarts may not be waning, but our influence is waning. And therefore, I think we should be more interested in the world around us.
Paul Keating on why we need a foreign policy urgently. Peter Varghese, is he right? And is our influence really waning?
Well, I don't share the view that we don't have a foreign policy. I mean, it may well be that we have a foreign policy with which Mr. Keating doesn't agree, and of course he's perfectly entitled to that view. But to my mind, there's no question that Australia does have an articulated foreign policy. To the extent that he's talking about the challenges ahead, and I've only got the media reports of his comments, I think they're in the context particularly of the US and China and the very issue that we've been dealing with. I don't think there's a strong case to be made that our influence is waning. You know, in the end, Tom, influence flows from weight. And Australia has influence because it can bring a certain weight to an issue. We're not a superpower, we're not a major power, but we are the 12th or 13th largest economy. We probably have the 12th or 13th largest most effective military. We're an energy superpower. We're a major resources player. We typically rank in the top half dozen in terms of our soft diplomacy. In some areas like international education, we're close to world leaders. See, I don't think those are the measures of a country with waning influence. I mean, I think in the end, our influence matches our capability, and I think that's still in reasonably good stead.
Yeah, well, you say influence comes from weight, but in 2009, the Defence White Paper warned, quote, "We're witnessing the beginning of the end of the unipolar moment, the two-decade era of American preeminence in the region." Peter, is US influence and power waning? I mean, is the post-Cold War era of US global leadership coming to an end?
I think what's happening, Tom, is that the margin of US influence or the margin of US predominance is waning, and I think that was inevitable. I mean, the unipolar moment was never going to last forever. And what we're seeing now is that in China, but not just in China, in a number of other nations, we have the makings of a much more multipolar strategic system. But in the near to medium term, there's no question in my mind that the United States will still remain the strongest global power with the most global reach and the largest capacity to influence events on a global scale. I mean, that flows not just from its large military advantage and the strength that it has in the projection of force, but I think it also flows from the fact that the United States will remain a very deep and substantial economy, as well as a country with a very long history and a entrepreneurial culture, which will place it at the forefront, the continuing forefront of innovation.
Well, on that note, let's hear again from Paul Keating this week.
The United States is still fundamentally pursuing a policy for the maintenance of primacy against the obvious rise of China, and therefore resisting the whole idea of sharing strategic power in Asia, which I believe the United States should do with the Chinese. Strategic hegemony by the United States in the Pacific is incapable of preservation.
That was former Prime Minister Keating at the Australia-China Research Institute this week. He's calling on Washington to share strategic power in Asia with China. Peter, you could argue that here's Keating sounding a bit like the ANU academic Hugh White. Are they right? Should the US and China share strategic power in the region?
Well, Tom, strategic power will flow from strategic and economic weight. And for Australia, you know, we need to keep a couple of things in mind. First, we've been the beneficiary of US strategic predominance in the post-war period. Mm-hmm. And in an ideal world, we would want to see that continue. Secondly, sharing strategic power is an organic process. And I would argue that it is a process which is already in train. Some people suggest that a sharing agreement with a capital A should be reached between the US and China. I don't see much value in that. I think what we have to deal with is a process of accommodation and adjustment as strategic and economic weight shifts. And indeed, it's precisely because we don't know in advance what the precise trajectory of those shifts are going to be that you don't want to lock yourself into a sharing agreement. And the other point I'd make, Tom, is that, you know, we are dealing with a more and more multipolar Indo-Pacific. And the future of that region is not just a question for the United States and China, although they will, I think, be probably the two key players in the foreseeable future. But this is a strategic matrix that also includes important players like Japan and like India and Indonesia, and in a different category, Russia. So the whole challenge of diplomacy is how you pivot and adjust with a degree of nimbleness to something that is evolving when you do not know what the end destination is.
What's the biggest challenge, Peter, facing Australian foreign policy in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think, as I said earlier, the settling point of China. I mean, we don't know where China will be in 5 years. We hope very much that it will continue to be a strong economy, and we hope very much that it will be more and more a player in a rules-based system. But the truth is, we don't know how this process in China is going to unfold, how China will deal with the political economy challenges. And I think this is something which hasn't had enough attention, that the really large challenges in the region, not just in China, I would add, is actually where economics and politics come together or don't come together. Because when you look at Asia, there isn't a single Asian economy that doesn't face deep structural challenges. And whether they have the political systems and the political will that's capable of dealing effectively with those challenges is a very big question. Too often, projections of economic growth ignore the political economy that sits behind everything we do in the economic domain. And because you can't translate that into numbers and graphs, it tends not to get the attention it deserves.
What you're saying here, it sort of brings to mind your recent farewell speech, because you highlight in that speech the need for more long-term deep policy thinking. How do you see this playing out? Because the bureaucracy's not getting the time to do the deep dive on policy, right?
Well, the bureaucracy in the end follows the rhythms of politics, because in our system, that's the way the relationship is, and it should be. But Tom, the question here is actually quite an important one, and that is, how do we ensure, particularly in a media environment of 24/7 and in a political culture which can be distracted by the tyranny of the current. I mean, there's nothing new about that. But how do we ensure, when you take all of those things together, that we have a political system and a political leadership that carves out time for deep reflection? Because without deep reflection, it is almost impossible to come up with effective policy frameworks. Mm. And so both the bureaucracy and, I think, our political culture needs to come to grips with it. Mm. And I hope we are only in a period of transition where some of the technology of communication is distorting our ability to think deeply as opposed to reacting instantly. But, you know, if we don't come to grips with this, then we will pay a rather large price.
Indeed. Now, finally, Peter, you've had a very distinguished career in public service. So I have to ask, what job did you enjoy most in government?
Well, I've had a very lucky career in public service, and I've had the great good fortune to enjoy just about every job that I've had. I think, you know, if you ever have a good first posting in the foreign affairs game, it stays with you all your life. Oh, and yeah. I had the great privilege of having not just a good first posting, but a wonderful first posting in Vienna. So in terms of joy, that would probably rank highly. But I think the job that I probably got the most satisfaction from in Canberra, and I've had jobs with a lot of satisfaction, was probably heading up ONA, just because you are by definition dealing with the big issues of the day. You're replenishing your intellectual capital. You can make a contribution to policy making through analysis which is anchored in a clear idea of Australia's interests and how the world works.
Yeah, which makes you think, how on earth did we cope without ONA before Malcolm Fraser set it up in the 1970s and early 80s? Peter, terrific to chat today, and all the best with your new role at the University of Queensland.
Thanks very much, Tom.
That was Peter Varghese, the Chancellor of the University of Queensland.